Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look at Canada and China. We are joined by three friends and former colleagues of mine, Stuart Beck, Ted Lippman, and Rob Wright. Stuart is CEO of the Asia-Pacific Foundation and served as our High Commissioner to India with earlier postings in China. Ted was our ambassador to Korea, and he too had various postings to China. Ted spent much of the last decade in Hong Kong running a foundation. Rob served as Deputy Minister of International Trade, then as our ambassador to Japan, and then to China. Ted is a CJAI fellow, and Rob serves on our advisory council. Stuart and Ted are in Vancouver, and Rob is in Ottawa. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Nice to hear you.
Thanks a lot.
All right, some context for listeners. Canada-China relations are at a low point. Some would say their lowest point since we established diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China in 1970. Why? Well, the three M's have a lot to do with it. Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou was detained by Canadian authorities at the Vancouver airport in December 2019 in response to an extradition request from the United States relating to fraud and Iranian sanctions busting. Days later, Chinese authorities seized the two Michaels, Spavor and Kovrig, and they have been held in detention ever since. Claiming our meat and canola were infected, the Chinese embargoed them. The meat embargo was lifted but remains on most of our canola exports. Canadians are troubled by Chinese policies on human rights, especially towards the Uyghurs, and in its treatment of the democracy movement in Hong Kong, where protests have once again broken out over national security legislation imposed by the National People's Congress. Then there is the fallout over COVID, the Sino-US trade dispute that is morphing into a new Cold War, concerns about Chinese rhetoric on Taiwan, and the militarization of the South China Sea. There is now a special parliamentary committee looking at Canada-China relations, including Chinese disinformation and subversion of students and new immigrants. As we mark the 50th anniversary of our diplomatic relations with the PRC, the Trudeau government's ambitions for closer economic relations with China now seem a long ways away, with public opinion polls showing increasing deep wariness about China. So we've much to discuss. Let me start with your overall assessment of the relationship, keeping in mind the Meng Wanzhou ruling the other day and things. Let me move first to you, Rob.
Sure. Well, thanks, Colin. I obviously, the relationship is poor, and it's about to get even worse. Yesterday's decision here in Canada may well result in more retaliation from the Chinese government. There's no sign that the Chinese government understands or wants to understand the independence of the Canadian judiciary. This is a process. The process here could drag on for many more years, and unfortunately, this probably means that the arbitrary detention of the two Michaels will now continue. Thinking about this, you know, for decades, our policy, Canada's policy with China, has been based on efforts for reasonable dialogue and engagement. But China has changed. The truth is they've changed. They see themselves now as a superpower. And over the last 8 years or so, since Xi Jinping became president, they've become more aggressive, more assertive. They've done this militarily in the South China Sea, and now we see evidence of actions in Hong Kong economically and diplomatically. And they're not averse to bully tactics, and we're part of that. We've been affected by it, as has Australia and some smaller European countries. So we clearly need to reassess how we're approaching our relationship with China. The view of China by Canadians has severely deteriorated. And will any Canadian government in the near to medium term be willing to reinvest politically in the relationship? These are big questions, but I think questions that we have to address and need to be answered.
A good starting, Ted. What would you add to what Rob has said?
Well, you know, looking back in the 70s when we established relations with China, the Chinese really needed Canada in order to come out of its Cultural Revolution, obtain the international recognition which Canada helped provide. There was an implied leverage in a sense that what we gave to China in terms of international recognition, the Chinese compensated Canada for with preferential access to markets, particularly agriculture and resource markets. You know, now China is much more confident and is pushing all of its diplomatic partners, not just us. You know, in the 80s and the 90s and beyond, China benefited greatly from this relationship. And I think they don't feel they need us as much as they did before. And both sides took this relationship for granted. Canadians, we've been lured into this belief that the relationship is somehow special because of historical ties, which the Chinese never fail to remind us of, Norman Bethune or Pierre Trudeau, who tended to overlook China's weaknesses. But, you know, he did see this greater Trudeau did see this greater strategic objective of bringing China into the mainstream. So in that period of time, looking backwards, I think the relationship has never been worse. This idea of friendship, which we kind of relied on, is kind of out the window. I'm very disappointed with that, having worked on that for many years. I think Rob is absolutely right that things are going to get worse. And maybe in some ways, and we want to get into this later, maybe they need to get worse before they get better.
All right, Stuart, things look like they're bad. Perhaps, as Rob says, getting worse. What do you think?
Well, I think it's the worst it's been since all of us joined the Foreign Service, Colin. It's as bad as, even worse than I think before Tiananmen, or after Tiananmen, I should say. So, yeah, this is, stark comparison to where things were prior to Meng Wanzhou. And so prior to Meng Wanzhou, you had the issues that were going on between China and the United States in terms of trade. We got put strictly into a box in our relationship with China over Meng Wanzhou, and we've had to cope with that. So if you had taken a look at our polling prior to, we did a poll in 2018, and prior to the Meng Wanzhou being picked up, and attitudes towards China were quite positive, relatively speaking, and also attitudes towards a free trade agreement with China were over 65% at that point in time. You wouldn't even come close to anywhere close to those numbers today. And again, that puts us in a very difficult position. And I have to agree both with Rob and Ted on, it's time for us to really make a reassessment of where we are. But it's a reassessment in the context of the geopolitical relationship between the U.S. and China and where we sit there. So we have to take a sovereign interest-based approach to this, because neither one of the two are treating us very well in many ways. And we need to understand that, yes, the United States is an important partner for Canada, and it will always be, and will always be our next door neighbor and friend. But at the end of the day, we have to consider, with the realignment of value of supply chains, with what's happening in the context of Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Hong Kong is very important to us. And you didn't mention what's going on between China and India right now, and that's another thing which really disturbs me. So these are all things that we have to take a look at. And then we really have to script a strategy for a diversification of our interests in the greater Asia region.
Okay, well, let's just push you a bit, because you spent 4 years as our High Commissioner in India. And as you point out, the China-India relationship, there's also challenges around border and, as you say, competitors economically. How does that play into, we've been trying now for years to get a freer trade arrangement with India. I remember Mr. Harper going over there, and Mr. Shostapo, but we don't seem to make any progress. So I buy what you say about the diversification, but is India going to be part of that?
Well, I mean, the free trade agreement with India, everybody's had a challenge with that, Colin. It's not just Canada. We went through 10 falls. Over the time that I was in India, we went through 10 rounds. So, and nothing really has materialized from that. But, they withdrew from RCEP. India, the India-EU issue, free trade agreement didn't come to fruition as well. So it's just it's an issue that will we ever get beyond it? I don't know. But that's not really the thing that concerns me as much as, the border disputes. This is something that's been going on since 1960, and when the Chinese really embarrassed the Indians. You're in a situation now, and it's very unhelpful for two countries that have been able to manage this issue, and they go back and forth, and there's always skirmishes and things that happen. But you don't want to insert the United States in this process, because it becomes another issue where you see kind of a hidden hand pushing things in certain directions. And it's really, this is what you can't really anticipate what the long-term impact will be. So you've got the problems in the South China Sea, you have problems with Taiwan, and now the Taiwanese are buying more military equipment from the United States. You have Hong Kong and the U.S. withdrawing Hong Kong status, which it's going to take a while for that to work its way through the system. But these are all things that create a whole lot of uncertainty and instability, which is really something that we have to throw into that equation when we think about our relationships in Asia going forward.
Which is certainly going to have impact on business confidence. What is your polling telling you about business confidence about either doing work with China or the rest of Asia?
Well, I'd say, in general, the attitude towards investment from Asia is very positive, and except for with China. But again, it's not across the board with China. There's a real concern about state-owned enterprise investment in Canada. So from that perspective, it's investment from other parts, and even in the technology sector, it is warmly welcomed. The challenge is really what Asians think of Canada as a business partner, and we just completed a survey of six Asian nations, Korea, Japan, Singapore, Vietnam, China, and India. And although there's interest in doing business with Canada, there's very little understanding of what Canada can offer. And this, again, but as much as we'd like to do business in Asia, sometimes people just don't understand what kind of business we can do with them. And I think once that we haven't officially released this yet, but the point of the analysis is all done, I think you'll find it very interesting to see what others think of us in the context of doing business in the region.
Interesting. Rob, you were Deputy Minister of International Trade. You know, we always look to push out, but obviously we wanted them to feel that we were an attractive partner. And what Stuart's saying is that there's still lots of questions, despite the best efforts of you and Ted and Stuart over the years. What have we got to do more in terms of, if we want to diversify and make Asia part of it, what is it we have to do?
That's a very important question, and there's no simple answer to it. At the moment, we have to get through the next 6 months, and that is the time. Hopefully, we'll have dealt in a little bit better way with the COVID crisis, and we'll get through the U.S. election. Who knows who will be elected, but whatever the outcome, will have a serious and important impact on whatever decisions we take in terms of our trade policy for the years to come. If I were an optimist, and I'm not really an optimist, but if I were, I'd say that China has every reason at this stage to be sending signals that they're prepared to back off a little bit some of these bully tactics that they've been deploying. But my guess is that they won't be prepared to do so until after the U.S. election, until after it's clear who's going to be leading the United States. Both the Republicans and the Democrats are taking very strong anti-Chinese positions. I think until the Chinese have a better sense of who they're dealing with in the White House post-November, I think you're going to see China being very reluctant. And I suspect that means for us that we're not going to be able to take any new initiatives in terms of trade policy that will be meaningful, at least between now and the end of the year.
And that walks me right into the whole 5G decision of the government and whether or not to use Huawei. The business community, as I know, is pushing the government to say, look, we want business certainty. But Donald Trump has been pretty clear that any country, especially of the Five Eyes intelligence network that uses Huawei, will get booted out. And that's a consistent message, not just from Mr. Trump, but also Democrats seem to have come on side. As you say, the election's coming. What would you do with the government? Would you continue to wait? I mean, we punted this decision forward. It seems that the pressure on the Brits, the Australians, New Zealanders has brought them around. So I saw the vote in the British House of Commons with Boris Johnson, and they seem to be saying, no, there's not even going to be space and it's got to be out by a certain time. What do we do in Canada where we've got big investment from Huawei?
Yeah, this seems to be delayed and delayed. I hope that the government isn't thinking that a decision on Huawei, one way or the other, will result in a decision by the Chinese on the two Michaels. I mean, if this is linked, if we're linking in our own minds politically, the fact that if we decide against Huawei, that this may result in even longer detention on the part of the Canadians, that's just giving in to these Chinese bully tactics, and that's not something we should do. I don't know the technical and security arguments for or against the participation of Huawei in our 5G network. But personally, in this environment, I don't see how we could possibly agree to allow Huawei into our 5G network. I just don't see how it's feasible.
Stuart, you talked about...
If that's the case, then I think we're better to make that decision sooner rather than later.
Stuart, you've been watching this. You've got the business community. You mentioned your polling shows question about Canadian investment. Now, obviously, I think Huawei is special because of the complications right now. But will this, if we say no to Huawei, will that have an effect on how Asians view investment in Canada?
Well, not often I disagree with Rob. I'm a huge, hugely respected opinion, and working with him, I know him very well. So, Rob, this isn't meant as a word of disrespect, but I just think we need a made in Canada solution to this issue, and it has to be known as a made in Canada solution that we're not caving to the United States and their quite frankly bully tactics on this issue. I think what we need to be able to say is yes, there are certain areas that we can't have 5G, Huawei 5G equipment in our system. Core is obviously the place. But again, keeping in mind, and people tend to forget, that the 5G technology that Huawei has basically is from IP that they bought. In this case, they bought, and there is argument that they've stolen IP, but in this case, they bought from Nortel when we didn't support Nortel in 2008 during the financial crisis. So this could have been Canadian technology. So why does CESC feel confident that they can make these decisions? Because they know and understand the technology very well based on the people that have been involved. So yes, the decision may be not to have Huawei in our system, but you know, both of you know what the rural internet is like in Canada. You know, the 5G is one solution to better rural internet, and we should be taking a look at these solutions. We may not want it in the core. We may not want it in our cities, so it might have an impact on the infrastructure. But much like on Taiwan, we came up with our own solution on Taiwan to take note. We should be doing the same thing in the context of 5G. We should come up with a made in Canada solution and not be seen to be pushed one way or the other, because it's not just China that's going to react. It's going to have an investment impact from other countries in Asia as well. So it's just, again, we've got to think in terms of the bigger picture. So that would be my take on it.
Okay. I want to move us now. Ted, you've spent a lot of the last decade Foundation and watching Hong Kong. Human rights is a big piece of the relationship, not just Hong Kong, but also Uyghurs, Falun Gong, Tibet. There are allegations about Chinese disinformation and subversion of their students in Canada. There's what the book, The Claws of the Panda, by Jonathan Manthorpe, detailing some of this stuff. Governments have taken different approaches over the years. The Mulroney and Gretchen approach, I think, was if you're going to raise human rights too much behind closed doors, Mr. Harper was more public. You've thought about this. What do you think? What works better and what should we do on the big issue of human rights, which is a big basket in the Canada-China relationship?
Well, it's a difficult question. It's been a key theme in our relationship since the 70s. In my experience, which goes back that far, neither the backroom chat approach of the Chrétien era, which sought to leave the Chinese some face and not raise these issues publicly, nor the public hectoring a la Harper, which was billboard diplomacy playing to a very narrow domestic audience. Neither of these approaches work very well without leverage. We've got many assets in Canada, which China wants and needs. But frankly, if those assets are readily available to China, they'll simply be taken. What are these assets? Things like, access to the Arctic, resources, technology, even our Canadian way of life through the form of immigration education of China's elite families. So for Canada, I think we need to first recognize what assets we have. And there needs to be some consequences, positive or negative, based on the behavior of our diplomatic partners, not just China. I think this is generic to our foreign policy generally for all partners. Without leverage, any approach, I think, is not going to be successful. And I think some of the comments made by both Rob as well as Stu point to that as an answer. It's not something we can do right away. It's more of a strategic issue. It's going to take a long time to put in place the kind of coordination that's required. Let's not forget that the Chinese are a lot better organized than we are. I don't think we ever want to consider a system like that. I may be dating myself, but I'm thinking back to the old comic character Pogo. He said, "I've seen the enemy and it is us." Neither the discrete approach nor the hectoring approach without leverage has had much effect on China's perception of their own best interests. And under the current circumstances, I think we're quite challenged to change that.
Stuart, the government has come out now with the British and the Australians around Hong Kong, and I think the United States is a piece of that. Is that what we have to do in terms of big human rights? Do it collectively with like-minded democracies to leverage pressure and hope that might as help, amongst other things, get the Michaels out? Or are we just kind of, what do we do?
Well, I think, if that exactly plays to Ted's point is, we alone don't have the leverage that can be applied. But when we work with like-mindeds in particular, and again, you have to be careful. It's interesting that we did this with the British and the Australians, because again, being closely associated with the United States on some of these issues right now, it just is not, it becomes very difficult just because of the relationship between the two big geopolitical powers. So again, this is something that we've been hoping for in the context of the foundation's work in terms of diversification, finding that like-minded or like-interest grouping of countries to take a look at how we would approach the region and how we would approach China as the biggest player in the region. So, the fact that we haven't paid much attention to Japan, and Rob, I think, would second this, over the last 10 to 15 years has really been unfortunate. And Japan can be a very important, how I like to term it, upper middle power that we can work together with in the region. It's very important. How do we utilize CPTPP as an instrument for us to diversify our supply chain network into Vietnam, Singapore, and other countries in Asia? And again, using that trade instrument that we have that the United States doesn't have to our advantage. So yes, it's how we build those coalitions of like-minded, like-interest countries to our benefit, because doing it alone, we just don't have the leverage that is necessary to deal with China.
Rob? I agree, if I may. Yeah, on both those comments, if I may, I think that's absolutely right. We should be paying a lot more attention to Japan than we have over recent years, and to our partners in the CPTPP. That gives us a real door into the Asia-Pacific region, and I think it's a door that China would love to have access to, and something where I think we can exert leverage on what's happening in China.
Well, the CPP also has kind of the values component: labor, environment, anti-corruption, transparency. You know, my sense is that the Americans with a new administration are more likely to come into it if that becomes the kind of standard, the model of which we are already a part of. And as you point out, Japan, I think as you phrased it, an upper middle power, Stuart. Rob, should this be the mechanism? Because we've been looking to put our Asian policy around a set of instruments. Should the principal instrument be the CPTPP?
I think it should be one of the principal ones, for sure. But I think, again, I don't know that we're going to be able to do too much around that until after the U.S. election. I agree with you. If the leadership changes in the U.S., if we have a new president in the White House, I'd be very surprised if the U.S. didn't move to join the CPTPP, and that's something we should support.
Now, you say one of an instrument. What others would you – you're sitting there as Deputy Minister of International Trade. You've got the CPTP in place. You've got free trade with Korea. Korea may well come into the CPTPP. What else are you going to be asking for looking at the big picture?
Well, at the big picture, at the broadest terms, I think we need to all – and we should be working with Pacific partners through the CPTPP, as well as other partners around the world. We all need to get together to look at how to reform the dispute settlement system in the WTO and ensure that it doesn't continue to wallow, and that it's had its teeth removed by the Americans. They've, in effect, destroyed the appellate process within the WTO, and I think that should be – very high on our priorities once we get through the November election in the United States.
Stuart, I take it you'd agree with that?
Yeah, and I would also say that, there are regional institutions that we've been trying to get into that becomes even more important for us to be involved, like the East Asia Forum. There are, when you take a look at CPTPP, we should be working with other like-minded. I don't think we want to take a lead on this, but certainly we can work with the Japanese on getting Taiwan into CPTPP. We just did a webinar this week with the digital minister for Taiwan talking about their COVID response. I mean, there's lots of common interest. Ted would understand that, because Ted was running our trade office in Taiwan at one point in time. I spent 4 years there. So there are things that we can do with Taiwan that we are legitimately important. And are trade related. It's not a political issue. These are trade related issues. So, I mean, that's an example of where we could be doing something that would be, I think, outside of CPTPP, but using CPTPP as a leverage instrument to get us into other instruments in other organizations within Asia.
Okay, before I go to Ted, because I want to ask him about Taiwan, you talked about.
Can I interject there, Colin?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and I totally agree, a lot of opportunities using, multilateral instruments to lever with, like-minded countries to lever some of our interests. But And I'll go back to my previous comment. I do think what is lacking is in terms of our own bilateral policies, our ability to deal not just with China, but with other countries who are very mercantilist in their approach, or as in the case of China, have a long history of acting in a certain way and are very difficult for us to sort of change them. We can change ourselves. And I do think that our inability or unwillingness to lever some of our interests with China and with other partners is a problem that we need to fix at home. You know, Stuart talked about a sort of a made in Canada solution, and I agree with that. But while we shouldn't ignore and indeed we should aggressively pursue these multilateral options, I think there's a lot of work to be done to coordinate our own policies towards China that and to other countries as well that will enable us to protect Canadian interests much better than we are doing right now.
Let me ask you about Taiwan.
I second that emotion. Absolutely.
Taiwan, would you bring them in the World Health Organization, change the name of our office from Trade and Economic, as the Dutch and some others have done, to sort of just the Taipei office? What would you do with Taiwan? You've been there.
Okay. That's a good question. And I think that one has to look what can realistically be done. I think that it's well known that the vast majority, in fact, over 90%, perhaps over 95% of the countries in the United Nations recognize Chinese sovereignty over Taiwan. Stuart referred to a sort of a specific Canadian solution that noted the mainland's claim, but that was done at a time when China really needed us. That would never happen today. So for China, sovereignty issues trump everything. If you look at recent Chinese history, you know, it was the sick man of Asia. It was taken advantage of by Western powers, at least that's their perception. I don't think that's going to change. So as long as China sees this as a threat to their sovereignty, no amount of a reasonable argument is going to convince them that Taiwan should be a member of the WHO, for example, or the WHA. And for them, this is an issue that is quite widely supported in China because Chinese people, whether they like the Communist Party or not, are generally quite patriotic. So I think we need to separate some of these issues from the sovereignty issue, which also plays into, quite frankly, you mentioned it earlier, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs. These human rights issues all have their origins in a fear of a threat to China's sovereignty. That is something that I think is at this particular point in time impossible to change. So I'm not optimistic that Taiwan, who also makes statements saying that they are an independent country, which most members of the UN don't recognize, that simply exacerbates China's paranoia about other agendas that there might be other than the health agenda that are threatening to their claimed sovereignty over Taiwan.
All right. Much, and we will be back to this. Mindful of Stuart's time constraints, let me move to one of the most popular features of this, and that's what you're reading. Stuart, let me start with you. What are you reading these days?
William Dalrymple's The Anarchy, his latest book about the East India Company. Fascinating. Yeah.
Excellent. Rob, what are you reading?
I just finished a book called The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. It's about Churchill's years in 1940 and 41, a political leader faced with a huge crisis not irrelevant to today's problems.
Well, my wife is reading it, and I'm going to read it next, so I look forward to it. Ted, what are you reading?
Well, I have a bad habit. I tend to read books on my phone, and I tend to read several books at the same time. I'm reading several books by Yuval Noah Harari. Sapiens is the one that comes to mind that I was just delving into yesterday, and I think a lot of what he raises in his writings is very, very relevant to not just what we've been talking about today, but to COVID, to our future, to the human race, and I just find his analysis fascinating.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Stuart Beck, Ted Lippman, and Rob Wright. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.